Welcome. I want to report the discovery I made. You're using all this plotting package called WGL Matje, and that's kind of inconvenient. I hear that even PDFs and GitHub doesn't show the figures. So I discovered a new Matje package, same user interface called Cairo Matje. WGL is for web and interactivity and beautiful, and interactive, and Cairo is for beautiful images. That is, Cairo renders to PDF and PNG and JPEG and makes beautiful pictures that can also be used in publications. And it turns out if you use Cairo Matje instead of WGL Matje, it works as well in a notebook interface. And I have the hope that these pictures also show up on the web. And maybe these pictures are nicer. For example, scrolling works if I'm on the picture and so on. So Cairo Matje, I recommend you to install it with add the usual way and then use it. And then the figure should appear. Oh, that was silly of me because I can't assume that it's actually faster than WGL Matje. Talk to you in a minute. Actually, I can just start a new notebook, can't I? Very good. So yesterday, during the tutorial, I saw that some of you struggled with the exercise, having to do that Monday's lecture was a bit fast, and it didn't actually explain how to take a finite difference. So I want to take the opportunity to go over that material, half of that material, at a bit of a slower speed to make sure that you also have this notebook as an example if you use it later. And then I'm going to continue from that towards solving the wave equation. I'm switching topics around. That was originally announced from Friday, but I'm going to do it today and then do elliptic equations on Friday. So first, discretization and convergence. And later on, we're going to solve the wave equation. Has the figure appeared? Yeah, figure's here. Look, beautiful. Too large for the screen anyway. So when we talked about convergence, the idea is that you have a function and you represent it in a discrete way, given some kind of resolution or such a thing. And convergence means that you test your numerical result for different resolutions. And so let's just think about that a bit more. Let me maybe even add a sketch here on the blackboard so that there's a visual reference. Whatever you're going to do. And there was a bit of a confusion with counting grid points. I'm going to simplify that quite a bit as well. So we have some domain here, and we split up the domain in a certain number of intervals. Let's call this n equals 4 in this case. We're just counting the intervals. And then the length of the domain is L, is then n times the grid spacing h, and that here spacing h. And then we still have a function or whatever lives on here. I'm going to sample set at these points. What's a chalk catastrophe here? And the lights are not ideal. Justin, if you can briefly switch on the lights, but then I'm going to switch onto the notebook, so maybe that's not too useful. Is that visible from behind?
Yeah, that's
okay. Maybe let's leave it like that. And if you can still see the screen, then we can leave the lights like that. So I'm going to write a function that just chooses the location of these grid points. And I'm calling this the discretization function. Function discretize, and as input, as suggested yesterday, xmin and xmax, which is the boundaries of the domain in 1D, and the number of intervals, not the number of points, or intervals, very easy. And I'm also going to introduce a thing called a convergence level, Because if you want to look for convergence, you want to increase the resolution. I used that factor alpha. That was a bit confusing. So right now I'm going to, maybe there's a different color somewhere here. Purple, why not? Yeah, that, no. Sorry. Where we add these additional points in here. And they have this convergence level. And then, I don't know, let's call it convergence level. And then I have L equals 1. So no. 0 makes it easier. And here we have L equals 1. And higher level just means it's finer in the end. So we can calculate the grid spacing. H is x max minus x min divided by the number of intervals times 2 to the level. So if the level is 0, it's just a standard thing. And then level 1, 2, 3, and so on, have half, quarter, eighth of the respective grid spacing. And see, no plus or minus ions, minus one and so on. If you count intervals instead of points, it's much easier to digest. And then the points that we have, you can use lin range, which is kind of a magic Julia command that does something. Nobody understands what it does. Instead, we are just going to calculate the positions of the points ourselves. It's going to be an array. And in this array, you're going to count the grid points, and the grid points are going to go I in from 0 to n int. And can you give me the expression here? It gives me the location of grid point 0, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. What's the coordinate of the ith grid point? X min plus.
I times
the space. Yes. It's exactly like that. And then let's discretize something and see what happens. Call it x0 because this is going to be level 0. And the domain goes from 0 to 1, much nicer than 0 to pi. That works as well. And let's choose. How many intervals? 4 intervals and level 0. And then we get these points. And since we have explicitly access to the points, we can also see whether it works. So we can calculate x1, 0, 1, 4, and level 1. And then we get more points. Can you see? No! Oh. You see the bug? If we increase the resolution, we're supposed to get more points here. But we have the same number of points, and they only go to 1/2 instead of 1. You see where the problem is in this function that I so self-assuredly wrote with a bug that nobody complained about?
You're not changing your n int.
Yes. An int is the interval, the number of intervals on the coarsest level. On level L, we have more intervals, right? We have twice as many intervals on the next level. So we need to calculate that as well. So we have more intervals. And then it's this one here, and this one here. This doesn't change. And at the next level, we have more points. And you see that every second point in between does not exist on the cross level. And I'm getting bored of the sine function. Does anybody have any idea of another function that we could discretize?
The cosine function?
OK. Maybe something more interesting than the cosine function.
Curve function?
Oh, yeah.
Pardon what? R function. Oof. Does it exist? What is called Earth? Does it exist?
Almost the inverse of Gaussian.
What about exponential?
Okay, I'll use the exponential function. The error function for sure exists. If one of you looks it up, I probably need to load a package or something to get the error function. Then we could do that.
Log of x plus log of 1 minus x.
Okay. If it's so complicated, let's define a function. Let's define a nice function. That's the one we're going to discretize. What did you suggest? Log of x of 1 plus x?
Sure.
I have no idea what that is. So, going to plot that function. Just to.
Yeah.
And then, big equals bigger. And then I choose a range here and I evaluate f there and I'm plotting that and let's see what happens. Is this log x function, is it something like the hyperbolic cosine or something? Did you just make it up or is this a real thing that exists somewhere?
Well, it definitely exists because you wrote it there. But
no, it doesn't look like a hyperbolic thing.
It does. No, it doesn't.
Oh, there's a thing called the soft sum, soft adding, where you first take the exponential and then you add them and then you take the log again.
Yeah.
What? Oh, man.
Wait. Is it a log by
hyperbolic? Yeah. Looks nice. It goes from 1.7 to 2.1. Okay. Someone could do me a favor and tell me how to make the figure smaller. Oh, wait, there's nothing I can do here, right? To make them smaller?
I don't think so, because I tried doing it.
There's probably a command where I can do that here. I don't recall. Anyway, let's continue. Where was I? We have a function. We want to discretize it. We have x naught is the coarse resolution and x1, that's the fine resolution. And let me know if I should slow down, but of course you're getting the notebook as well later on. So let's define f naught, which is just the discretized functions. Discretize the function. F naught is f applied to the coarse x coordinates, and f1 is f applied to the fine coordinates. No, that was not what I wanted. And then I'm going to plot these things again. I'm going to plot the discretized function.
I
have to use the Christmas colors again, of course.
Christmas colors.
Looks like if you pass in the figure call, you can do resolution equals something in pixel size, I guess.
Yeah, that's good. Let's make it a bit larger. No, that's nice. Now you can see both at the same time. Okay, that is. Okay. Oh, I need to plot it the other way around. If you plot it the other way around, then it plots the fine one and then the coarse one. And since there are fewer coarse points, now you see both the coarse points on the fine points. So remember, there are green points below the red points as well.
Why did you put a semicolon in the figure? What was the first entry that you needed to?
Oh, you don't need the semicolon. That's just a style thing. You can leave it out. Yeah. It's just I like to put a semicolon in front of keyword arguments. Sorry, don't mean to confuse you.
Also, is that a code practice that people do to make things clear?
Maybe not. I like to have my code formatted automatically. There's a package for that, and that package does that in its standard format. I don't know. Some people have weird ideas how code should be formatted. I'm just too lazy to format it myself when I work on a project, so yeah. I just use some standards there. Okay, that is that. Now we want to take a derivative. So discretizing it is pretty boring because so far we just sampled the function and there's nothing special going on, except for the weird calculations here with number of intervals and so on. Now, let's talk about calculating a derivative. That was the finite difference. I explained how to do a finite difference here with x plus h and x minus h. And do I need to explain that again? You know, I'm not going to do that unless someone asks. So now, finite differences. I'm going to write a function that calculates the derivative of a discretized function. And it takes as input the function values. And just to be fancy, I'm taking the same arguments as the discretization function above, namely the number of intervals and the level. And then I copy from above the code, sorry, scrolling a bit, where I calculate the grid spacing. It'll be there in a minute. Now, we need to calculate the derivative of f. F is an array that holds the function values at all these grid points. I want to use centered finite differences, as we did yesterday. And as you remember, we can only do that in the interior. We cannot do that at the boundary. So we're going to have to introduce a special case for the boundary. Actually, stop. I want to talk about something else first. Of course, there are several ways of introducing calculating derivatives. So it's going to be a bit of blackboard. This will be useful later on because that has to do with boundary conditions and how to handle values at the boundary. And there are two main approaches for handling boundaries. And the first, and I'm going to mention it first because it's the simpler, is called ghost zones. It's the same idea as mirror images or mirror charges in electrodynamics. Ghost zones or ghost points. And the second would be one-sided finite differencing stencils. It's clear if you do something at the boundary, your finite differencing stencil can only extend one direction, can't go through the boundary. One-sided finite differences. Now, ghost zones work as follows. So you have your domain here, and you have your points. And then what you do, you extend the domain past the boundary. You add additional points here, maybe one, maybe even two additional points here. And the question is, of course, what values do you put in here? They're kind of pseudo values, they're outside of the domain. And if you have a good prescription for that, then ghost zones work and they're beautiful. But if you can't come up with a good prescription, then this method is no good. Now, let's assume you have a symmetry here, for example, that you have a sine function and you know that whatever sine function you have looks like that, and it's always antisymmetric about this point here. Then you know the function value here always the negative of the function value there. So if you know the values in the interior, you can just make them up by taking these points and multiplying by minus 1. Exactly like mirror charges and electrodynamics, where you just look at your charge distribution interior and times minus 1. And there are other cases, I'm going to use a different color, where you know that's not antisymmetric, but maybe symmetric about this origin. And then you know the value here is the value here. But you know what I mean, even though the figure is not very good. You just take the value here and copy it, and it's going to be the same as the value here. And in particular, in the first case, when you enforce things to be antisymmetric, by definition, the value here is always going to be 0. So if you have a boundary condition where something is forced to be 0 at the boundary, then there's a good chance that the function will end up being antisymmetric, and then you can use ghost zones. And what you do is you only care about the domain in the interior, then you fill up these ghost zones, and then you can calculate the derivative here using the values in the ghost zone. But for example, when you plot something, you might not even plot the ghost zones. Why would you? And one-sided finite differences, well, if you have a function that lives here, and if you want to evaluate a derivative here, this point, then you take the value here and the value here, and you calculate the derivative by subtracting them from each other. And then you, for example, have something like f I plus 1 minus f I minus 1 divided by, since they are 2h apart, by 2h. But this would be in the interior. And at the boundary, you have a different stencil. Since you can't go to I minus 1, it would be f I plus 1 minus f of I. And you divide by what? Only by h, because they are only h apart. And we had that. This is a one-sided stencil.
It's just like the symmetric and the one-sided. Yeah.
And this is also called centered. So if you want to evaluate the derivative here, you would use this. And if you want to evaluate the derivative here, then you can use the center derivative. Obviously, at the right boundary, it's the same as this one, except it's fi and fi minus 1/2 that you can. And now if you add ghost zones, of course, it's a bit more complicated because your array is larger. You just had 4 intervals, 5 points. If you have 2 more ghost zones, the whole arithmetic becomes a bit more complicated. But it's really just as complicated as adding 2 and not getting confused. Today, I'm going to use centered finite differences because that fits nicer with the thing. You have more questions or other suggestions for that? OK, let's go on. I'm going to allocate an array that will hold the derivative of f. And this is Julia function called similar, which creates an array using kind of all the information of f. So it creates an array with the same type and size and shape and so on, but it doesn't fill it with values. It's just a convenient way of allocating something. And then this is the left boundary point. Let's do the interior first. Let's fill the interior of the f. For I in 2 to length f minus 1. Because we're in the interior, we can use a centered stencil. So we're going to have to leave out the 2 boundary points here. And then we have dfi equals, and this is just the finite differencing stencil for the derivative that I wrote there. Fi minus 1 divided by 2h. And now we need the boundary points. And I like to do things in order. So the left boundary, I'm going to do it above that loop, and the right point below that loop. That doesn't really matter. And the right boundary looks similar. Can you all follow this code? So I assume you can all follow this code and understand what it does with that explanation. But actually coming up with the code yourself might be a bit more complicated because you need to know what to do. You need to think about what arguments the function should use and so on. And I saw that some of you struggled with that code yesterday. So I want to show it to you as an example. And next time you come across a problem like that, you can go back to this notebook and see how it's done. And after you wrote it 2 or 3 times, you probably can do it yourself. Do you have further questions regarding that code? No? OK, then let's go on. Then let's calculate a few derivatives. We have a function f0. Let's calculate the derivative. df0 equals the derivative of f0. And then we need to pass in the original. Number of intervals. How many intervals did I use for f0? You know what? I'm going to introduce a variable for that. You can't recall anything. It's always good to introduce a variable. Oh man, it doesn't even scroll. At least it slows me down. Sorry, an int is 4. And this is just an int and level 0. And this is also the same number of points and level 1. And now let's scroll back up here. And level 0 and the f1, the derivative of f1. And then I'm going to plot the result again. Sorry, I'm scrolling and copy the plotting fluff.
Wait, sorry, Eric, what did you define as an int?
Oh, that's the 4. Sorry, let me scroll up. When I calculate, when I did the first discretization, I used to have a 4 here.
Thank you.
No, I just, the number of intervals. It's kind of the global number of intervals. What? Oh no, how inconvenient. Now we need to pass x min, and was that a clever thing that I did or not? Yeah, no, I'm going to change it. This is too inconvenient with all the n ints and so on. I'm going to change my derivative function. Sorry, it's going to accept h, the grid spacing in there. It's much easier for the function. Sorry. This is not a really elegant design, but it'll be faster. So my derivative function now got shorter. The first 4 lines vanished because I pass in the grid spacing directly. And then I can really concentrate on just calculating the derivative. Now I have to, of course, calculate the grid spacing here manually. That is a bit less elegant. And here we have the result, which is these function that might or might not have a name. And the red, the coarse resolution, and the green is the fine resolution. And as you see, the results differ. That means they have different amounts of error in them. And now I want to continue with what we did yesterday, namely calculating the errors and looking at the convergence order. I'm not going to do the Richardson extrapolation. that's going to be part of the project that you have to do for this module. Okay, could I move on? Not yet? Okay. I'll be happy to wait. Okay, I'll rename the notebook in the meantime. Save notebook as... Now, I also noticed that some of you are further ahead than others. If that is the case, then you can implement fourth order finite differencing. Fourth order finite differencing is a more complicated stencil. You can look it up on Wikipedia. There's an entry on finite differencing coefficients. You can just go there, look up the coefficients, and then use fourth order finite differencing. And then if you do that and follow the notebook here, then you should get fourth order convergence with errors that are amazingly small compared to second order convergence. Okay, ready to move on? Okay. Now, we have a function at different resolutions, and we have the function at different numbers of grid points, and we have them stored in these arrays, in these vectors, and since the arrays have a different number of elements, the vectors have a different number of components, there's a telltale sign that these live in different vector spaces. So the continuum function is kind of an infinite dimensional vector space, analytic function countably infinitely dimensional. And the discrete vector spaces have a finite dimensional and different number of points. Now, if you want to compare the functions, compare two vectors means to subtract them from each other, then you need to live in the same vector space. Now, we need to have a function that kind of projects one of them into the vector space of the other one. I'm going to use restriction here. Restriction means that you reduce the size of the vector space. So I'm going to take the level one function and project it into the level zero function. I'm going to write a function to do that. I'm restrict by one level. You need to be careful if you call a function restrict. Sometimes restrict is a keyword of the language and then it wouldn't work. And this restriction, since we restrict by one level, it doesn't need any arguments. We don't need the grid spacing because I assume that the grid spacing differ by a factor of two. So it just take every second grid point. Let's call this FC for F course. Let's call it F course. Sorry, no, that's the fine one, right? Fine. And then F course. Subtract every second grid point, and then f course equals f fine 1 in steps by 2 to the end. So rather straightforward expression. Now let's test restriction. And we test it on the coordinates, because if you restrict the fine coordinates, you better get the coarse coordinates. Otherwise, something works really funnily. And then we have restrict of x1. And they should be the same as x0, right? Well, let's subtract x0. And the result here should better be very small. There you go. Perfect.
So small.
Now we can also restrict f1, df1, that is the derivative of the fine function. And the result will be, well, it's this one here, whatever that is. And then we can restrict, call it arrow 0. So df0, that's the derivative of the coarse discretization. Df1 is the derivative of the fine discretization. Restrict projects the coarse into the fine into the coarse vector space. Now I've set course, and find wrong three times. Now you don't understand anything anymore. Anyway, this is now the error between the course and the fine. And this is the thing that should be small. This is the thing that needs to converge to zero. And you see, it is rather small, right? 0.0 something, but it is not actually it's not actually infinitely small. And I spend a bit of time deriving the particular equations for getting the convergence order or for the convergence factor. Not going to do that again. What people usually do is they just look that up somewhere. There's a difference between the convergence order and the convergence factor. The convergence order is that exponent p, and the convergence factor is just the ratio between the two things. Also, let's calculate the convergence factor. Oh, yeah, no, let's actually also define the known solution. Do we know the real solution?
Yeah, it was the function
we defined. But the derivative, what's the derivative of that function?
Take that.
It's just a little chain rule.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you do that?
Yeah. What was the function again?
Like the log of an exponential.
Okay. Sorry, I'm copying the function down here. Then let's do it together. But I could also take this at the teaching moment and actually show you how a three-level convergence test works if you don't actually know the derivative of that function. But let's do that here. So this was f, and then df. Okay. The exponent of 1 plus x, the derivative is?
Exponent of 1 plus x.
This is?
You take the e out, and then you have the log, of exponential of x plus exponential of minus x.
And then you divide by
the 2 cosh. Log 2 log cosh.
Look, I'm standing here in front of a blackboard. I can't do the magic that you're doing. You tell me what to write here.
Oh, yeah, take this and put it over what was in the inside, and then you can cancel out.
I think it's tangible.
Is it that? No, it's not that.
This is going to be over what's in the argument of the log. And if you wanted to, you could
like that.
Yeah, and you could cancel out. You see, it's exponent of 1 plus x, but you could take out the exponent of 1, and so you've got an e in every single one of those terms, and you could just factor out the e's.
It's tangent.
Okay. Too complicated. This is tang. Okay. Very good. Okay. Let's do the convergence factor. Sorry. The convergence factor, let's call it CF. This is the coarse error divided by the fine error. The coarse error is df0 minus df of x0. So this df0 is the discretized function, and then we take the discrete derivative. Here we have the grid points, and we apply the function. So this is the derivative, if this is correct, without any error. This is the derivative with an error. So this is the error we have on the coarse grid. And we're going to divide that by the error that we have on the fine grid. And and since we're doing it with vector spaces, we need to take the fine error and restrict it to the coarse grid. Sorry, this is just the conversion. Yes, there's no of x anymore. No. Oof. Oh, very good. it solved the linear system because I wrote over, and then the result was a matrix. I don't want to do that. It is so confusing that you make one error and then. And this is the convergence factor. And look at it. Look at that beauty. What does that tell us? Well, first it tells us we don't have enough many points, right? Using four intervals wasn't good. I should have used 10 intervals or something. We can change that later on, or you can change that. But what does it tell us? It tells us that the convergence factor is mostly 4, and the convergence order is the log of the convergence factor, the binary log. So the convergence order will be beautifully 2 in the interior, and at the boundary, the convergence factor is totally equals to 2. I mean, that does not matter at all in this kind of experiments. That means the convergence order on the boundary is only 1. And if you recall the stencils that we used here, standard stencil is second order accurate, the one-sided stencil only first order accurate, and this matches beautifully our expectations. Actually, it's too beautiful. I wish it was not as beautiful, because in real life it will never be that beautiful, but apparently it's good. And oh, the fact that it worked also means that the derivative that you cooked up is correct. Thank you for that. Why am I using the log to base 2 here and not something else? Okay. Yeah, the y-axis here is a bit wrong. I wish I could extend it from 1 to 2. There's probably a plotting argument for that, but I don't recall offhand what that is. We set the scale of the y-axis. Okay, why am I taking log 2 here and not some other kind of basis?
I'm not sure.
Because the factor between the resolutions is a factor of 2. That is easy done in 1D, but if you do expensive calculations, you might have to use other factors, because you can't increase the resolution by a factor of 2. That might be too expensive. You might increase the resolution only by 50%, and that would be then the log to the basis of 1.5 or something that you need to take.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Did you figure it
out? Okay. Do you have more questions on this topic? Okay.
The values, yes, that you defined here is a predefined constant, apparently. I don't know, maybe it's just in Julia 184.
What predefined constant?
I don't know, because when you write CF, I change the name, because CF, it says it's an already defined constant. You're changing a defined constant.
Really?
Yeah, that was weird. I changed it to C underline F. It worked.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Maybe you define something else?
No, the same thing happened to Bacha.
Over here. And Catherine.
Okay, let's look up. No, there is no CF in here.
Maybe we should try it on ours. Huh.
Well, there is a CF here, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you type question mark CF, yeah, and then you see where it comes from?
Yeah, that's one. No, there isn't.
Should we define it?
That's weird. Maybe
if you define a function called CF, yeah, that counts as a constant.
That's the thing. Yeah.
When did we define a function?
Because you defined it, shift and entered it. I did that as well. It defined that. It has it in the system.
I got a different error.
If you have a mystery like that, I recommend restarting the notebook, and then this should go away. Yeah. Okay, very good. Now, I could continue to show you how to do the three-level convergence test. It would be very similar, except that we do the thing with three levels, and the convergence order is calculated differently, because you don't have the analytic solution. So you can't use that df of 0. Instead, you have to use df 1, df 0, and df 2 here, according to the equations I wrote down. If you don't mind, I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to move on to another topic that's a bit more advanced, where instead of just taking a boring function and calculating a derivative, I mean, who is interested in doing that? I'm going to show you how to solve the wave equation. That is similar to the advection equation. We're going to set up some initial conditions, and then you're going to run a code and evolve the wave equation. Sounds good?
Yeah.
Very good. I'm even going to open a new notebook for that so that people don't get confused. new launcher. And the wave equation is definitely a partial differential equation that needs to be solved. So let's write it down, how it looks like. And let's spend a few minutes talking about how we're going to discretize that. In 2D, we have dt squared of a function u of t and x equals dx squared of u of t and x. In higher dimension, same thing, except that becomes the Laplacian, you have a dy squared and dz squared. Different from what we did so far, these are second derivatives. There are various ways to handle that, but one easy way is to use the centered finite difference for a second derivative. I'm running a bit late. I'm not going to show you how to do that. I'm just going to show you the stencil that you get. So the second derivative of x, dx squared of f x, is, if you do the Taylor expansion, hope I don't mess it up, f of x plus h minus 2 f at x plus f of x, sorry, let's write minus h here, that's what most people do, plus h divided by h squared. You remember last time I wrote down Taylor expansions? You take f expanded at x plus h, x minus h. You can do that. Include all the terms, including second order, the second derivative. Let's write this f double prime. You add them up. Last time we subtracted them, then the second derivative canceled. Now you add them up and solve for f double prime, and then you get this term here, plus, of course, higher order terms that I'm ignoring here. And because you add them up, you get this factor 2 here, and so on. And so if you have a function here, and grid points, say we have one point here, and here, and here, this is x, x plus h, x minus h, and the second derivative, you add these and you subtract these. So if this point is smaller, then you get something positive. And indeed, this function here is a positive curvature, right? It's approximately parabolic. So you kind of see that this is a good approximation for the second derivative of the function. Make sense? Skeptical? Bored?
If you calculated your derivative with a midpoint derivative, so f x plus h minus
yes.
x minus h over 2h.
Yes. Yes.
Here you three f four functions. So f is f of x plus h, f of x minus h, and f of x.
No, it's the same thing. If you translate it into fi, then this is f I minus 1 minus 2 fi plus f I plus 1. So x plus h becomes I plus 1 and so on. But second derivative, so the denominator is h squared instead of h.
No, I'm just saying if your first derivatives were f of x plus h minus f of x minus h,
yes.
Over 2h.
Yes. Oh, okay, yes. Okay, there's the thing. If you calculate the second derivative as two consecutive first derivatives, and if you know math, you might think that is a good idea. And you're not getting this. Then you get something else that has 4h squared in the center and has 2h here. That points to one of the major shortcomings of finite differences, that the second derivative is different from two first derivatives. It's a bit mind-boggling if you're used to math. But this is one of the approximations that one makes. The one that you suggested, no, that one is not good, because that one actually uses only every second grid point and then leaves the other ones out. And that leads to kind of a decoupling, even, odd, and so on. So numerically, that would have bad properties.
Okay.
Now, what you can do is you can do a first order first derivative, kind of a one-sided derivative that goes in one direction. Mm-hmm. And of the result, you take another one-sided derivative that goes in the other direction, and then you end up with this.
Yeah, okay.
So that's kind of good that that works. But if you take the good, the second order, and apply it twice, that doesn't work. I was not expecting to get into this, but this is a very good observation. There are discretization methods where that works. They're really good. I like them much better than finite differences. It's kind of a variation of finite elements. But since finite differences is so much easier to explain, I'm explaining them to you. Yeah, there's a selection effect. I'm explaining finite differences because they're easy to understand and they're easy to implement, not because they're good. If you actually want to use them, then they show their disadvantages at some point. But they're not bad in the sense, right? They just have some disadvantages that might not be obvious. Okay, now we have a function that depends on two and t and x. So our domain is now two-dimensional, not just one-dimensional. T goes up, x goes to the right. I'm a relativist, so we have points here. Okay, I'm drawing a few more points here. And to solve this equation, you're going to need initial conditions and boundary conditions. And since there's a second derivative in the t direction, it's not enough if you just specify u at the initial time. To specify, you need two initial conditions, u and u dot, and then you calculate u double dot here. So what I'm going to suggest is a rather simple method to use, where we have a two-dimensional grid with a certain number of grid points, and then we set up initial conditions on the first two rows corresponding to the first two times. That means implicitly, if we know the solution for two times, then we also kind of know that it's the same thing. You know then the solution and the time derivative of the solution. And we're also going to specify boundary conditions on the boundary points at the outer boundary. And at the remaining points in the interior, we calculate the solution. It looks as if this was a rather small domain. Of course, in real, that would be the majority of the domain. And we're doing that by taking this finite differencing stencil and applying it in here. Going to look for a different color. And if you look from the top, if you calculate, say, the x derivative, the second derivative in the x direction, then you would have a stencil that uses these points here. You look at this and this and this point, and then you know the second x derivative here. Do you see that?
Just by using that formula, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. And we can do the same in the time direction, where we use these points here. And then we know the second time derivative here. And if you place the stencil here, then you know the solution everywhere at all points of the stencil, except this stencil point.
Why?
So we can solve that stencil for that futuremost point, and then fill in that point here.
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused. What do you mean we know it at all points except that point?
Assume you have initial conditions given at the orange points, mm-hmm, and boundary conditions at the pink points, and you place the stencil here. I mean, these points here are still orange, just I overwrote them, but this still is still white. Then all these points are given except this one. And then if we solve for that stencil point, we know the solution here. It also works if the stencil is here at the left, that we can fill in this point here. We don't need to do it all the way here because this is a boundary condition that is given. We're doing it here. We're doing it here. And then we shift one to the future. And then we discover the solution working from the past to the future. That's called time evolution. And that is a simple algorithm. Solve the wave equation. It would also work for the advection equations or other things. And this is what I suggest we implement in the remaining half hour. And it's a bit more complicated, of course, than what we previously did, because 2D, not 1D. But apart from that, structure of the finite differencing stencils and so on is not very much different. And I think I'm going to, now I'm going to, yeah, okay. Ah, okay. I'm just thinking about notation because you have the number of points here and the number of points there and what you introduce on the grid spacing. Let's write a function for some let's write a function that fills that 2D array with the coordinates of the grid points. You wouldn't really do that because no point in storing the coordinates, but it makes many things easier here. And what you need is ni and nj and dt and dx, sorry, n and i and dt and dx. And n is the number of points in the time direction, and I the number of points in the x direction, and dt is the grid spacing, and dx is that grid spacing. And I'm just going to put that at the origin for simplicity. And then we have two coordinates, t and x. So t equals, what is it? Dt times n times dt. And the first, I'm going to find the first direction, the I direction. And this produces two arrays, two scalar arrays, one for the time coordinate. So the time coordinate is kind of a scalar field that lifts at all these grid points. Of course, the time coordinate here and here is going to be the same, but that is the condition. And since we have this four here, four statement with a comma, it's a loop over both I and N. So in our 2D array, the first index will be the spatial index, the second index will be the time index. And the x coordinate will be the same, except it's given by I times dx. Let's see how that works. E comma x equals port. How many points? Let's use 4 and 4 and grid spacing 1 over 4 and 1 over 4. See what happens. Looks kind of good, right? I mean, you don't see anything, but could be correct. Okay, are you following?
Wait, sorry, why the, okay, would you mind saying one more time why those coordinates? Is that?
It's always nice to know the coordinates of the grid points. You need that when you set up boundary conditions or initial conditions. And it's just a simple function, and it helps us get acquainted with the notation, with the two-dimensional arrays, and so on.
Right.
So at just the time, it doesn't really make sense to calculate them because n times the x, so I just store them in an array. But we can certainly do that. And I'm going to put a standing wave in there. That's just an easy thing, a wave that kind of flops up and down, doesn't do anything. And I pass as input the coordinates, because the standing wave solution depends on the coordinates. Okay, standing wave. Okay, let's write a solution. This would be u of t and x equals cosine 2 pi t times, yeah, not very good, times, no, sorry, sine times cosine, no, that was right, cosine. Sine 2 pi x. Anything with sine and cosine will be a solution to the wave equation. You can verify it's a solution if you take a second time derivative, then the cosine will turn into minus cosine and you get 4 pi squared out. If you take a second time derivative, the sine goes into minus sine and you get a factor of 4 pi squared out. So the second time and the second space derivatives are the same. And I oscillated between cosines and sine here because I just want to have nice boundary conditions. If you use that with a sine function, then it's going to be 0 at the outer boundary, which is what I want to have for the boundary condition. And if I put the cosine here for t, then for t equals 0, you actually see something and you don't start with something boring. That is flat. But anyway, that is a nice analytic solution that we're going to use. So u equals cosine of 2 pi t times sine of, and we need the dots after sine and before the multiplication because we're applying this to an array. Well, x times x. Oops. Yeah. And now let's plot it. And now it's a bit more complicated how to plot that. Now we need a heat plot or something. What was it here? Resolution? Actually, I want it square now, obviously. And what is it? Is there a heat thing?
Are we plotting two figures?
One figure.
How come it's 1, 2?
Oh, ha, ha. That's just me automatically counting. Okay, sorry. I need to spend a minute look at the Markier documentation.
Sorry, I'm looking up. I'm trying to look it up.
It's contour plot. It's contour F. Aha.
So you're going to do contour
F. Yeah, let's see that. And it probably wants it in the opposite direction to you. And you, what's you? I just totally defined you. But I didn't call the function, okay. Oh, I don't want to see that. Well, I do, kind of, but I want to see it nicely. Contour plot wants a 1D array, not a 2D array. Can we reshape it? Can we fix it? So this is a problem with multidimensional equations, that there's a lot of new dimensions must be consistent. But there's a vec function that I could use, right? Vec translates it to a 1D vector, but that works.
If you wanted a heat map, it's
there you go. That's the wave equation. And it's probably even correct. We have so few grid points that we don't see anything. But you see kind of that, is it correct? Not correct? No. This is the time direction, and this is the x direction.
No, sorry.
These are the initial conditions. So this is the x-axis. This is the time axis. So it's moving this way. And we also set up our initial conditions on all the grid points, but just on the initial points. That is also a bit suboptimal. Yeah, okay. There's a different function vec that turns any multidimensional array into a vector. This is what I should have called here.
Does it just flatten it out or something?
Yes, yes. It just puts the grid points next to each other.
X and T because
That's what I'm trying to do. I want to transpose the plot. And I probably also have to transpose the arrays for that. Let's see what happens now. Looks good. Maybe, maybe not. Okay. Someone here was really silly, just plotting that thing with 20 points.
What did you define as your U prime?
Sorry?
Your U prime. What's the prime? That's
prime is the transpose. So I need to transpose the arrays because I want to plot them the other way around. And I'm restarting the notebook because I made changes. Also changed my arrays. You have 20 elements. I'm sorry, I'm going so fast. This is not good. I think I should slow down because there are also technical problems that I have with just plotting a 2D thing that I didn't properly test ahead of time. And then if that spills over into tutorial Friday, that should not matter too much. Okay, now you can see the standing wave. I hope it's a standing wave. Apparently, there's a way to add a color bar. I'm sorry. Let me try to be fancy here.
Sorry, why did you transpose your X, T, and U? Because I didn't and still gave the same result.
You're getting the same result?
For some reason.
Sorry, then let's skip doing that. What I wanted to do, are you sure you're getting the same thing? Because this is not quite symmetric when you rotate it. Because this is the initial condition, this is the sine wave. It goes first up, and then zero, and then down, and then zero. So yellow is plus one, and black is minus one in this color map. Okay.
Just up the primes. But why? What?
Okay. Well, what we put in there is highly symmetric design function and so on. So I'm sure one of us is incorrect. I'm not sure. There's a 50-50 chance, so I'm not sure. And of course, this is the time direction where the wave, the top of the wave turns into a bottom and turns into a top. And that happens here. But right now, we didn't solve the wave equation, right? We just accidentally put initial conditions everywhere. So this is not a good thing. I didn't want to do that. So let's fix that in our initial condition routine. So we want to put initial conditions everywhere in space, but only on the first two points in time. So let's write it differently. Let's just copy the time coordinate. And then loop over all the elements of the array. And if the editor lets me type, then I'm going to set the initial condition separately for every grid point, and then it's easier to see what goes on. And I'm also going to set boundary conditions here. Sorry, you're only going over two here. I'm trying to speed up. That is not good. I'm confusing you. I'm sorry for that. Okay. So with these comments, is it clear what the routine does? So I use n for the time coordinate and I for the x coordinate. Now there's another bug here because I need to run over all the points in space. So let's examine the array T, the time array. And size returns the number of points in the space and the time direction. And then maybe that makes it easier to understand. If I write an I and number of points in the I and number of points in the n direction. Then I loop over the first two points in time and all the points in space and set u to the initial conditions. And then I set the boundary conditions by looping over all the points in time and setting the value of u at the left and at the right boundary. And then let's see what happens if you plot this. This should look much uglier. There you go. This looks much uglier because we left the complete interior undefined and we only set things at the boundary and for the initial conditions.
Ugly, also different. Mileage the same. What happened?
So what you see in the interior is kind of the random content of the memory, and that should look very different for you.
I made the same mistake.
Mine doesn't have those white chunks.
Mine has different white chunks.
Yes, everybody has different white chunks. Oh. You get a random unidentified content of memory. It's a really bad thing to do. I'm going to change it. Instead of similar, I'm going to write zeros. Then you get an array filled with zeros, and then you don't get any chunks. Ah, doesn't work. Okay, zeros and I, comma, and n. Yeah. And then you see that. And now you should see all that.
Okay, and I come.
Wow. Okay. And by now I prepared everything to get started with the meat of today's lecture. But given the current time, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to open it for 5 or maybe 10 minutes of questions so we can recap something. I'm going to move the remainder to either the tutorial on Friday or the lecture tomorrow, because it doesn't make sense to rush through anything here. Okay. Well, maybe let's recap the approach that we're going to do next time. Maybe one of you actually wants to start doing that on their own. So the idea is we solve the wave equation dt squared equals dx squared. We're going to use finite differencing on a two-dimensional array. Then we take x derivatives in the I direction and t derivatives in the n direction. Lots of opportunity to get confused with the first array index and second array index and then actually doing things in the wrong direction. This is the stencil here, rather this one down here, to calculate a second derivative. It's the values at the two outermost point minus 2 times the value in the interior divided by h squared. And there's a nice check. If you add up all these coefficients, 1 minus 2 plus 1, you get 0. And if you calculate the first moment of these conditions, minus this coefficient, minus 1, plus 0 this, plus 1 times this coefficient, you also get 0. That means the stencil is insensitive to any constant function and any linear function, but it will beautifully be sensitive to a parabola, as you see here, divided by h squared, because that's what you do for calculate the second derivative. Now we apply initial conditions in this 2D array on the first two rows, the first two points in time, and set boundary conditions, left and right boundary. That leaves most of the points in the interior undefined, here, right? And then we put our stencil in such a way that only one point of the stencil pokes into still undefined white points. Everything else resides in the points that we already know. you take this stencil, I mean that we discretize this equation, and then we move most of the terms on the right-hand side, except the fi plus one term of the time derivative. You're going to solve for that, and then we are going to calculate that point, looping everywhere over the interior, making sure we're going past the future, because that's what you need to do for a hyperbolic equation. And then we're going to see the solution for the wave equation everywhere. I'm going to save that notebook. Okay. Do you have questions? Are you stuck? Doesn't seem like that. Then I'm going to end a few minutes early because I need to leave at 5. And I see you tomorrow morning in the lecture.